In March 1993, Staley forced its employees to work mandatory rotating 12-hour shifts instead of normal 8-hour work days. Each shift is from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Staley employees work three 12-hour days in a row, have 3 days off, three on, three off, and so on, changing shifts every 30 days. This replacement of the regular calendar with a corporate calendar allows Staley to increase its employees' work time 100 hours per year.
The supervisor had given me the wrong respirator. So when I got off the truck, I pulled the respirator off because I was throwing up. And the supervisor, he came over to me and he said, Jeanette, he said, you know, we hired in around the same time and we had to die sometime. And the sad part about it, his lungs collapsed 2 weeks later.
The company tried and hoped that they could intimidate us enough to get mad enough to lose our cool and to strike. But it was clear, had we chose to strike, we would have been starved into submission very quick. These multinationals use all of these financial backers and all these fancy law firms and all of these things with these big heavy hitters to come at you from every angle.
We look at what is happening at the A.E. Staley Manufacturing Company in Decatur, Illinois. The terrible working conditions that the workers are forced to endure. But we also, through a documentary, Deadly Corn, see how the interlocking relationships are of the corporations themselves. How supposed competitors actually collude, and the financiers work behind the scenes of it all. Right now on Alternative View. During the Reagan-Bush years, there was a devastating assault on working people, which had horrible effects on working conditions and income. We see a documentary on one example of this, produced by Labor Vision in St. Louis. But before we see our documentary, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
Here's one of those complicated stories which the Spotlight specializes in. They do this frequently, showing the things that happen in the world of intelligence agencies or in the world of business, and how the scandals meet the world of politics. There's a big one they have in the July 5th article. It has a story about how Ron Brown, who's former head of the Democratic National Committee and a lobbyist for some of the most rotten regimes, like the Duvalier regime. And he's Secretary of Commerce. Well, he apparently, according to this story, and it's being investigated by the FBI, he entered into a deal with Vietnamese-American businessman who is charged that in return for lifting sanctions against Vietnam, old Ron's going to come up with about $700,000 to the good, plus a bunch of residuals from certain types of business deals if they go through. The Florida businessman is Lee Tran Binh, and he said that he served as executive vice president for a front organization, the Vietnam Development Corporation, and they're big people in the government of Vietnam, and actually also a former Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister of the Republic of South Vietnam were involved in this. The Communist Party chief, a Prime Minister, are all involved. Well, Ben, who one reason he was chosen for this is that he speaks fluent English because he was a graduate of Tulane University in economics, he said that in a sworn affidavit that the $700,000 for Brown would, in return for being placed into a special account in the Vietnamese government in a Singapore bank, for a percentage of income resulting from deals between American oil companies and other big businesses that they're hoping that the Vietnamese will be able to pull off and set up as a result of Brown's efforts. You know, there's an embargo at the present time that we're reporting on this against Vietnam. Ben actually met with Brown in 1992 in November, where they set up some of these this deal and gave Brown exclusive lobbying rights for it. Now, under the banking agreement they had, Ben said that $50 million was scheduled to come from a Swiss bank account maintained by none other than Papa Doc, or Baby Doc, Jean-Claude Duvalier, who was the fallen Haitian president. And this was supposed to be arranged by Brown, because, you know, Brown had been a lobbyist for Duvalier. And that would enable them to open a private bank immediately in Vietnam and do the financing of these deals. Now, why did Ben actually bring this to light? Well, he started having second thoughts about this, thinking that maybe he was in a bit over his head and some things were going down that might be illegal, particularly because Brown was Secretary of Commerce and he didn't want to be a go-between, because it's usually the little guys at the middle level who get stuck with holding the bag on these kinds of deals. So he has talked with some people that he really trusts. Two people, a retired senior vice president of a major U.S. oil company, and who the Spotlight talked with, who confirmed this information. Now, if Brown is to be able to pull this off, and as commerce secretary, he's in a good position to do this, he's really going to have a lucrative contract for himself. Why haven't you seen this on the regular media? Well, CNN sent a news crew to interview Ben about his allegations, but nothing has come out yet. And the Spotlight approached other major news organizations, and they haven't reported on this story. And meanwhile, apparently, because the story is beginning to leak out, the Vietnam Development Corporation has apparently closed down its Wall Street office, and the Vietnam operative who was trying to set it up and use Ben as the intermediary, he's returned to Vietnam. So maybe they decided to beat a hasty retreat, but the regular media aren't touching this story.
Yeah, we'll talk about some other stories that the mainstream press hasn't been covering. When Defense Secretary Les Aspin revealed the Pentagon spending plans for 1994, he was pleased to tell reporters that the Clinton administration had devised the first truly post-Cold War budget. Well, the May issue of The Progressive wonders just how much more military spending the administration would have proposed if the Cold War was still going full blast. During the 1992 campaign, Clinton continually denounced George Bush for failing to recognize that the Cold War was over. But Clinton's $260 billion defense budget is a mere $10 billion lower than Bush's and retains all the weapons from the Reagan-Bush era. Not one major weapons system is scheduled to be canceled. The truly post-Cold War budget even includes military hardware that Bush didn't even want. Military hardware such as the Seawolf submarine and the V-22, which is a tilt rotor aircraft. It continues funding Reagan's SDI and provides more money for such flawed projects as the C-17 cargo plane and the F-22 fighter. The Clinton administration plans to purchase six new warplanes for a cost of $432 billion and is developing close to 100 major weapon systems at a cost to Americans of over $1 trillion. Why do we continue with military spending levels that made no sense even when Reagan was trying to rout the world of the evil Soviet Empire? Well, the Progressive seems to think that the reason is because, even though the Cold War is over, the Cold War mentality still exists. The budget is based on the assumption that the United States will need to intervene in a number of trouble spots across the world. And indeed, we continue to do so in places such as Central and South America, Eastern Europe, the Persian Gulf, and the Middle East. But what possible threat to the United States' interests justifies such a bloated military establishment? Only the threat that somewhere in the world, someone will choose to follow a different path than the one decreed in Washington, and that that someone will be brought to heel by the U.S. military. Well, when the Soviet Union collapsed, many Americans thought that our nation might finally begin to focus on home and our own problems and return to a rational and more modest military budget. Many thought that by electing Bill Clinton, they could speed this process. Apparently, they were wrong.
You know, it's so ironic to hear the Clinton administration and Aspen saying, well, now we've done away with the Star Wars. It's over and done with. The Star Wars era is over. And they changed it to a new name. That's all they did. Star Wars is still there. They just changed it to a new name. And everybody's saying, oh, isn't that wonderful not having to have that horrible Star Wars anymore.
Here is our first of two nasty NAFTA reports on alternative views. Ali Husseini talks with James Scott of the Public Citizen Organization.
I've heard that Mexican truckers are going to be allowed to drive in the U.S. at Mexican wages and by Mexican standards as well after the beginning of the agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an issue that is of great concern to groups like ours. Public Citizen is a consumer organization. We were founded on the issue of highway safety, and currently, as currently proposed, I should say, Mexican truck drivers will be allowed to enter the United States using Mexican rigs, which are an average of 15 years old versus the average age of an American rig being 5 years old. They don't have to have something as basic as front disc brakes, which are crucial in the United States to keeping trucks from fishtailing when they have to brake really fast. The drivers aren't required to read English. They don't have the random drug testing that American drivers have. You know, problem after problem in terms of safety and highway safety. The weights of the trucks don't have to meet U.S. specs. These drivers will be able to enter the United States, pick up and deliver at any point. In other words, they could drive in from Mexico, go all the way up to Maine if they wanted to, deliver, but not only just deliver and pick up and return to Mexico, but deliver, pick up another load, take that to California, you know, and move about freely. And I'm not sure how long this can go on, but and then finally return to Mexico. That places U.S. truck drivers at a distinct disadvantage in terms of wage competition. Mexican truck drivers currently make an average of $7 a day. American truck drivers, I'm not even clear on how much they make, but I'm sure that it's not competitive with $7 a day.
And also, given the volume of cross-border trade that's going to occur under NAFTA, what will this do to, say, the importation of not only illegal drugs, but also just substandard agricultural products, infected meat, infected plants? Generally, right now we have laws protecting the U.S. environment from certain kinds of plant infections, fungi, and things like that. Is it going to be possible to regulate all this?
Well, currently, the drug problem is a glaring example of border inspections being lax. Currently, less than 1% of produce that's imported into this country is inspected, and that's a very brief spot inspection. And under NAFTA, there's going to be intense pressure because of the increased volume of traffic for inspections to be sped up. So you can expect even less and less as a percentage being ever inspected in terms of looking for things like tainted meat or excess pesticide residues on produce. So that stuff's going to end up on your dinner table. The Canadian agreement is a very, very clear example of this. After the agreement went through, inspections of meat had to be reduced because of the volume of meat coming across from Canada. And the Canadian shippers knew which batches were going to be inspected, and I'm not sure if that was part of any agreement or just part of the process, what actually happens in reality. But when certain news media programs went and inspected themselves and started doing spot checks on some of these, they found tons of tainted meat entering the U.S. from Canada. So there's a definite concern, and that concern is in everything from the inspection of produce to the interdiction of drugs to something like finding out if the products that are coming in from Mexico are actually made in Mexico. There's a lot of concern among the labor movement that Mexico will just be a grounds for which imports from other third countries will enter the United States.
And I've heard that Japan, for instance, is preparing to set up shop down in Mexico as a way of getting around trade barriers between the U.S. and Japan.
And not just setting up shop there, which would in fact benefit some people in Mexico at least, but just export, you know, toys from China to Mexico and then come up here with a stamp made in Mexico on them, which is not at all unrealistic. It's very, very difficult for them to police things like that at the border, and as evidenced by, again, how well they are able to stop the flow of drugs into this country.
We'll have another Nasty NAFTA report later in the program, along with some more news from the alternative press. But now for the main part of our Alternative Views show, the documentary Deadly Corn, about the struggle of the workers in Decatur, Illinois.
I was bagging up, coming out of the truck. I was gagging because I couldn't breathe. And I found out that I had the supervisor had given me the wrong respirator. So when I got off the truck, I pulled the respirator off because I was throwing up. And the supervisor, he came over to me, and he said, Jeanette, he said, you know, we hired in around the same time, and we had to die sometime. And the sad part about it, his lungs collapsed 2 weeks later.
Staley plant in Decatur, Illinois, processes corn into starches, syrups, and sweeteners. 800 workers there are represented by the Allied Industrial Workers Union. Since September 1992, they have engaged in a battle for their lives, their health, and the future of their community, all which they say is threatened by corporate greed.
What you see on the outside when you pass in front or over the viaduct, it's a different animal on the inside. I mean, they're hot. A lot of the buildings are old and outdated, and there's just miles and miles of pipe and conduit and conveyors and equipment and piles of either fresh or soured production. And when you get in the refinery and the starch areas, it's either all white and dusty and very explosive, or in some of the areas like the refinery where they do the sweeteners and the syrup, it's sticky and extremely hot.
The plant at Decatur today is a chemical plant. Dave said it best of all, it's a chemical plant. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we didn't have the chemicals out there we have today. They use it today to speed up the process, you know, and there's caustic, there's sulfuric acid, there's ethylene oxide, propylene oxide, there's chlorine. It's a chemical plant. And people have to be schooled and educated as to how to handle those chemicals. It could blow up the whole end of town out there.
In 1988, A.E. Staley of Decatur was bought by Tate & Lyle, the largest sweetener conglomerate in the world. Based in London, England, Tate & Lyle has acquired other sweetener companies around the world, including its best-known brand, Domino Sugar. Tate & Lyle implemented harsh labor policies and ignored environmental regulations in its new facilities, thus reaping additional profits. It also quickly amassed record fines from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and from the Environmental Protection Agency. One-third of Tate & Lyle's $400 million in profit in 1991 was from its Staley subsidiary.
In 1988, Tate & Lyle took over and immediately started ignoring the contract and not what we thought they were going to be as far as a parent company. Staley management began to take a different focus on how they treated and worked with employees. Safety and health is one of the things that started to deteriorate as well.
In 1990, Staley's deteriorating safety conditions cost Jim Beals his life. Beals was killed when toxic propylene oxide gas was released into the cornstarch processing tank in which he and Jerry Sumner were making repairs. Larry Shook was the safety man on the job.
Jim had just written a grievance on about the handling of the propylene oxide in the plant.
He had been to the Union Hall that afternoon, right, telling them, and wrote a safety observation that somebody was going to get seriously hurt with these chemicals that afternoon. It's on file.
It's on file. That, the handling of the propylene oxide, unqualified people, according to OSHA, there's supposed to be the minimum amount of people, qualified to do this so that, it don't overlap. You need a qualified person to do it. And there's only explosive. It was pipe fitters, the only ones supposed to work around this propylene as far as the handling of it, and they've been violating this.
They think more of production than they do life right now. Because never, in as long as I was over there, and I was in that area longer than anyone, did they ever run both reactors, one reactor without the other, without shutting it down.
I got down into the vessel, and Jim Beals followed me in. So we were in there. I don't know, we'd been in there maybe 10 minutes. And me and Jim see some water, looked like water, coming down from one of the holes in the top of this vessel. We hauled her at Larry, they're pumping something in on us. And I was in there maybe 10, 15 seconds before I was suffocating. And by this time it was really pouring in, At first it looked like a shower head around the outside of this pipe. And it was coming in, we knew it was PO, and I told Jim, I'm getting so-and-so out of here. And he says, but that's PO. I remember closing my eyes and holding my breath and grabbing hold of one of the arms, thinking, well, maybe I can slide along the bottom, because I was suffocating for air, and this, it was just that fast.
It takes the oxygen out of the air that quick. That's what it does.
So I remember sliding towards the opening, and I was out of it. I remember going towards a light, but I had my eyes closed, so they told me it was probably a lack of oxygen. Made you see the light they're always talking about. I remember, the next thing I remember, I had my head outside the vessel, and I couldn't breathe. I got out, and I was on fire. I mean, all the areas on you, your soft skin was just burning. My face on fire from this PO.
We were thinking, man, we got to do something. Well, Jerry's yelling at Jim when he comes out of there. He's soaked with it now. Can you imagine? Knowing that it's carcinogenic to you if you get it on you, he's covered with it. He
Scott
wants to get
Air
another
pack
one.
Was not working. Okay.
Yeah.
They had 15 Scott Air Packs in the plant, and not one of them in the whole plant was charged over 30%. They were all useless. Outside this room, there's emergency oxygen, 10 bottles of oxygen along the wall. They were all empty.
There was a colony of air. Nothing that they had for our safety worked. They had oxygen bottles downstairs outside and had a tube, rubber hose that run from outside up to this vessel, to these vessels, and you're supposed to be able to go down there and turn them on. Nothing worked.
I can remember trying to go back in the hole, and above this hole there was I-beam supports, okay? And the I-beam, probably 12-inch I-beam, and all these gases were trapping up there. It was 175 degrees. And I do remember I had my head back in there. I do remember seeing Jim sitting there, and he hadn't even moved. I remember seeing his shirt and, hollering and screaming at him. But he didn't even move. He was still in the same position. The company was completely in wrong doing this. It's getting back the way it was.
It's probably worse than it was right after the accident. It's a public relations thing to let the community know that they're really doing something about it. But the truth of it is, it's completely opposite of that.
The safety at the A.E. Staley Company is hard hat and safety glasses and banners at the gate. And despite what Larry Pillard says, safety is not a reality in a plant. And I think that can be best depicted by the fact that we no longer have full-time safety trainers from the union. We no longer have a full-time safety chairman for the union.
and there's only really two people left in the safety department with very little experience in the plant.
They don't care. They really don't even care about their company people either. They got company people. They got engineers. There's this lady, she's 26 years old. She's going to be running a supervisory job in the dry starch area. She's an engineer. She has no idea what's even going on. She's just there, you know. And it's like, you know, what's going to happen if somebody gets hurt or injured or something? She has no idea what's going on. She won't even know what floor. Someone says the dryers are down, she won't even know where to go.
And drums weren't labeled. And the operator had told me to go upstairs and dip so many canfuls of this liquid in this drum up there and dump it in this tank next to it. So the liquid was towards the bottom of this 55-gallon drum. I had to take the lid off and dip. I had to get my body down in there to get it, the liquid. So I got it on my hands and my arms, but I didn't know what it was. So I dumped it, did what he told me to do, and about a half hour later, I started getting sick. I had stomach cramps real bad, and I was sick to my stomach. So I went down to first aid, and they said, well, you must be having a touch of the flu or something. So when I came back, and it got worse, so I went home. I only had a couple hours left to work, but I was just too sick. So I went home, and when I came back to work that night, I found out that in that drum was rat poison. It was rat poison. I had it all over my arms and all over my hands. I guess my skin absorbed it. That's why I was sick.
As far as the safety issues, my own personal experience with it was with the chlorine leak they had here about a week or so ago. Our supervisor was warned that there was a chlorine leak, and he took it upon himself not to inform the rest of the building. So no one knew about it until it was over with. And I found out later on that the chlorine is very dangerous. You can die from it.
So they sent me back into maintenance. Okay, this is about in August after the May accident. I'd been a year and 4 months later. They sent me over to the reactor room to check on one of these seals. Okay, we go up to the door, the big door on there says, check with your foreman for the SOP, the standing operating proceeding, before you enter this room, okay? We call the supervisor. He don't even know what I'm talking about. He has no idea. It's amazing that, you know, after somebody loses their life, and they still don't, you know, have a standard operating procedure for doing work on something like that.
It's a sad thing that the people of the community have only the media to understand what's going on. It's awful bias. They tell one side of the story, and as far as any of the workers, we never, you know, we just go do our job.
Their attitude on safety, if you stand up, they're going to try to take you down.
Iraq had a bunch of black scummy goo all over it, you know. They didn't know what it was, had no idea what it was. And a guy told me to clean it up. And I said, you know what this is? He says, no, I don't think I know what it is. I said, well, it's an unknown sub, since we have to find out what it is before I can clean it up. He says, I think it'll be all right. We'll just use a scraper and start scraping it up. He didn't have a facial on. He was just scraping his stuff up, you know. He had no idea what it was. So I refused to do it, and he got mad that I refused to do it. He told me to go back up on my job. Well, come to find out, it was a toxic material. It was below 3.0 pH. And because of that, that means it had to be dealt with and had to be disposed of a certain way. And what I was supposed to do was wear a rubber suit with rubber gloves, taped up with a face shield and everything else, and rubber boots to clean this up. And I got reprimanded.
We had one deal. One of the guys down there that was the operator, Mr. Brazel, was the head of the cogen, called him up in his office and was going to give him time off, reprimand him, because we wouldn't hook plant air up to a caustic truck.
So the truck driver wanted to hook our plant air up. He's supposed to use his own air. Several years ago down there, they had one of the delivery guys come in, hook our plant air up. This caustic, the line come loose, and it just, I mean, it ate him up. He's blinded. We don't even know if he lived, really. They haven't told us anything, but his skin was falling off of him when he come into the laboratory downstairs for help. His skin was just falling off, and we do know he's blinded. And they wouldn't tell us what actually happened to him. We don't even know if this man lived.
When you work in different buildings out there, you're exposed to different chemicals and things. And in the boiler room, it has asbestos, lots of asbestos. And then in a building they shut down, 16 building, a lot of chemicals that cause cancer. One of the guys I worked with, who's like 44 years old, over in the boiler room, just last December, it might have been November, when he went in for his physical, they found a spot on his lung, and it's cancer.
I went to the hospital, had half my right lung removed. 4 or 5 months later, they cut my benefits. I felt like I had to go back to work. I think the cancer came from Staley. What I had was large cell cancer, which is only found in 16% of lung cancer patients. That's pretty rare cancer, so I'm saying it came from what I ingested at Staley's. The conditions I work in, there's asbestos hanging off the walls in a boiler room. That's my basic job, is working in the boiler room. There is asbestos everywhere. My other job is working in waste treatment. They use all kinds of chemicals to treat their water with over there. I'm around every bit of that. I've had half my lung removed, and they did not take that in consideration whatsoever. Apparently, they don't care about me, because if they did, they wouldn't have cut my benefits and forced me back into the plant. All we're asking for is a fair contract, something that we can live with.
In September 1992, Staley presented its workers with a contract that further undermined worker safety and health. Workers refused to agree to the contract. Staley began to unilaterally implement its conditions. In March 1993, Staley forced its employees to work mandatory rotating 12-hour shifts instead of normal 8-hour work days. Each shift is from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. or 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. Staley employees work 3 12-hour days in a row, have 3 days off, 3 on, 3 off, and so on, changing shifts every 30 days. This replacement of the regular calendar with a corporate calendar allows Staley to increase its employees' work time 100 hours per year. This means workers never have the same days off each week. In addition to the physical toll on workers, they are always out of sync with their families and the rest of the community.
We both had headaches all the time, from lack of sleep. Everything's disturbed. Even to be, you know, very plain about it, even your bodily functions are disturbed. You're tired, so you're not as alert. Yeah. Your reaction time slows down. Especially if they ask you to, well, they don't ask, they tell you to report on your day off.
In a few days, we're going to be rotating back to days. And that, you can't get used to this going from one.
And the 3 days off that you have with your family, when you work the night shift, the first day when you get off at 6 a.m., you lose that because you're napping all day. The second day, you're still kind of groggy, so you're doing a few things around the house or going to family functions. By the third day, you start to really, you know, you get your strength back, you've got your sleep, and
time to go back.
The way they are managing the plant today, or mismanaging the plant, I should say, they have generated a lot of major hazards, both to the employees there and the community at large.
The ethylene oxide was used in some of the bombs, the cluster bombs in Iraq, and they were using 40 pounds, approximately to 40 to 70 pounds in the cluster bombs, and we are using 100,000 pounds just in the process. So you can see that the potential there to the community, and this community should be aware of this, and they should be alarmed.
You walk in there and you don't know if you're gonna blow up or whatever.
They don't care what happens to Nancy Hanna. They don't care what happens in Decatur. They don't have to see it. They don't have to hear it. All they do is give the orders. You do this. If you don't do it, I'll get somebody else to do it.
I don't know whether they think about us as being human beings, and it don't make no difference what we have to sacrifice to get them more money. That's what they want.
Everybody was infuriated with this management that was kicking us around and treating you like a dog and showing you I'm the boss and you're nothing and this is the way it's going to be. The company tried and hoped that they could intimidate us enough to get mad enough to lose our cool and to strike. It was clear had we chose to strike, we would have been starved into submission very quick. These multinationals use all of these financial backers and all these fancy law firms and all of these things with these big heavy hitters to come at you from every angle.
Workers are fighting not just Staley Company, but a powerful web of corporate alliances. Staley's parent company, Tate & Lyle, may be in England, but Staley has a powerful domestic ally in its assault on its workers. That ally is Decatur neighbor Archer Daniels Midland, an $8.5 billion agribusiness giant. ADM is supposedly a competitor of Staley, but through a British subsidiary, ADM actually owns a controlling interest in Tate & Lyle. Thus, ADM stands to benefit from the defeat of Staley workers, not only because such a defeat would set the tone for labor relations in Decatur, but because ADM stands to benefit directly from Tate & Lyle's profiteering. Acting on this tangled alliance, ADM built a pipeline in Decatur between its plant and Staley's to provide product to Staley in the event of a strike or lockout. ADM is pursuing labor policies similar to those now demanded of Staley workers, including 12-hour shifts. ADM has also left a trail of federal violations on safety and health and violations of antitrust. For example, in 1978, ADM was convicted of conspiring to fix prices on foodstuffs sold to the Food for Peace program. The company is also a heavy polluter, releasing 1.9 million pounds of toxic substances into Decatur's air, water, and soil each year. At the head of ADM is Dwayne Andreas, a powerful political operator in both the Republican and Democratic parties. ADM was the largest contributor of so-called soft money to both political parties in the last presidential election, making Andreas one of the country's most powerful political figures. Connecting this web of corporate spiders is the insurance empire State Farm Mutual, based in Bloomington, Illinois. State Farm is the largest bond and stockholder in ADM. It is also the largest bondholder in other anti-union companies, including Caterpillar.
The corporations and the financial institutions have joined their economic and political power to fight workers and to fight their unions. So basically, what we're saying to workers and the unions and other sympathizers, it's our solidarity versus theirs. They have a coalition of power. To meet that power head on, we have to build coalition strength and take them on.
Continue to get the public opinion and sympathies, and we worked with the clergies and the community and got the churches involved and got more strength from the spouses and family involved, and we've just grown it.
What we have now is over 200 people on an average coming in, and as a body on the floor making this pretty strong decisions on what we do inside the plant, outside the plant.
You can't fight just strictly from the outside. You got to fight from inside and outside.
For the better part of those 9 months, the workers engaged in one of the most creative and ultimately empowering activities that I've seen in years.
We have safety stand down, safety confrontations with supervisors.
I work to rule.
I work to rule.
You do what you're told to do.
And that's all.
And that's all.
What makes it tough for the company is their average supervisor has less than 3 years seniority in that plant. I have 25 years on the same job, and they're going to tell me how to run my job. We are just letting them know they need us to run that plant.
This is the most solid group of people I've ever seen in my life. They do things, they do it as a whole. It's almost like a school of fish. When one turns, they all turn.
And you, membership, have took direction, and you took control, and I applaud you for it.
Hundreds of allied industrial workers, their family members, and friends converged at that address to protest in front of A.E. Staley's manufacturing headquarters. The grain processing company locked out its hourly workers Sunday.
Staley's executive vice president says the union's in-plant work strategy has made a return to normal operations impossible.
Who locked you out? Well, as far as I'm concerned, Staley, Tate & Lyle, Domino Sugar locked you out.
It's all one and the same thing. There's no question, again, that ADM and Tate Lyle are much one and the same. There's another thing there, percent of ownership in Decatur. How much of Decatur does ADM and Dwayne Andreas own? And by that, I don't just mean physical property. How much of the politicians does it own? Okay, how much of the community and business leaders does it own?
All of it.
Okay, how much direction is this company and Dwayne Andreas given about bust the unions so that Decatur really becomes a 21st century company town where they prey on the workers and they prey on the environment? The State Farm has a controlling interest in Archie Daniels Midland. And if State Farm wanted ADM and Dwayne Andreas to do something, they have the power to force them to do it.
It's our solidarity versus theirs.
Help Staley workers win this fight. Boycott Domino Sugar. Don't buy State Farm insurance.
And if you'd like to help out the Allied Industrial Workers Local 837, write to 2882 North Dineen, Decatur, Illinois, 62526, or call 217-876-7006.
A brotherhood kind of thing and a sisterhood kind of thing.
If people don't stand up to these corporations, they're going to use words like competitiveness to drive the wages down, and I would say undervalue the working class. They're going to devalue the working class. We don't come to die. Now while you're up there talking in an air-conditioned office on a telephone that OSHA approved, go on and tell me how much you've been spending on safety. Pardon me, I'm not moved. There's only one way to put
workers, not only in the United States, but probably in the world, have got just as many rights to a decent standard of living as do the powerful or the governments and the big business people that think it all belongs to them. We create the wealth. We suffer probably the most enduring consequences by being exposed to the hazards of creating this wealth, and they live in these air-conditioned, climate-controlled environments, and we're in the sweatshops, and people deserve a better standard of living, better life, more voice and control in how they're affected on the job with health and safety, and their families are. Watching Alternative Views, originating from Austin, Texas. Now let's return to the Alternative Press for some more news stories.
In These Times has a new feature called the Apollo Meter of things that are particularly appalling. And here's one. The Colorado Springs Gazette-Telegraph reports that 19 months after a United Airlines flight attendant died in a plane crash, the company sent her family a bill for $411.56. The company said that was how much the woman owed for the uniform that she had died in. That's kind of gruesome. Then the Progressive has a little bunch of shorts called No Comment, and they have one that indicates that Levi Strauss & Company shirts that are marked Made in China also bear the slogan, Nothing is more American than Levi's. Well, we know about Levi Strauss from Austin because they've just closed down a big San Antonio plant and opened up a Levi Strauss factory in Mexico where the workers are going to get paid a pittance of what they got paid in San Antonio. And when Bill Clinton came to Austin last week to have a meeting with the Mexican president about the NAFTA treaty, The workers from Levi Strauss's in San Antonio were there to demonstrate. And during his press conference, you couldn't even hear Clinton hardly because the protesters were chanting so loudly that they didn't want to sell out. They wanted to be able to keep their jobs.
Since Bill Clinton and his group favor so-called managed competition to give us all health care that's going to be adequate, instead of coming up with something more comprehensive and significant that would really do the job, some opposition has occurred, and from a couple of very significant sources. One, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, and the other, the General Accounting Office. Robert Reischauer, who's the director of the Congressional Budget Office, said that he didn't think that managed competition would really reduce costs. He testified to a House subcommittee that the proposal for managed competition wouldn't produce any savings at all, and it would leave national health care expenditures approximately the same. Now, by contrast, Reischauer thought that costs would be more easily controlled in a single-payer setup, such as what they have in Canada. He said that it would have saved $30 to $35 billion in administrative costs in 1991. Well, what about the General Accounting Office? They've said, they investigated, this is the investigative arm of Congress, they estimated that even including universal coverage, a Canadian system would immediately save the United States $3 billion in annual costs. Of course, Bill Clinton isn't going to give us that type because he is supported and financed and controlled by the big corporations and the big insurance companies. And they, of course, like the system the way it is.
Let's have another nasty NAFTA report. Ali Husseini interviews Chris Green, who's a researcher and writer, particularly on the environmental aspects of NAFTA.
So let's say that I've got some sort of illness resulting from pollution coming across the border. Is there any entity that I can sue? Is it legal for me to go and hire a lawyer and take care of this problem at all?
Well, traditionally in the U.S., what happens is that we've got these citizen suit provisions in the Clean Air Act and other acts, which allows citizens or representatives, environmental groups, to directly sue an agency for its lack of enforcement of environmental standards, or to directly sue a company who is polluting under various tort regimes. But as far as international pollution, presently there is no provision. And that's one of the fundamental problems. The Clean Air Act only mention of international pollution is stuff that problems caused by the U.S. in other countries, such as the U.S. polluting Canada with sulfur dioxide. And that has been less than enforced. Canada, the province of Ontario, actually, after 9 years after the EPA was notified that U.S. emissions were causing damage in Canada. The province of Ontario sued, and the court there said still doesn't matter unless you can point to specific sources. There's nothing that can be done.
So if we look at the precedent of Canada, it doesn't seem like NAFTA is going to improve that record for U.S. citizens at all.
No, and also there's the recent, even making them worse, under the recent forum non-convenience ruling passage in Texas starting September 1st, a U.S. company causing damage abroad cannot be sued in a Texas court, saying because it's inconvenient for the company to be sued there rather than in the state where the environment was harmed. And that brings up the problem, the state where the harm occurred. So you say Mexico. Right now, Mexico has virtually there's no public participation in enforcement of its environmental regulations. So if a Mexican citizen wants to go in and file a similar suit, well, one, they don't really know, Mexican citizens aren't really informed about what the environmental agencies are doing at all. They can't get any information on the emissions of plants. They can't get copies of environmental impact statements. They can't get any of that. And additionally, what they can do is file a citizen denunciation with the Attorney General's office. But what that does, they can basically just ignore that. If that is ignored by the Attorney General, there's then nothing further that the citizen can do besides an administrative hearing. The Supreme Court of Mexico has yet to decide a case saying that they recognize you have to show direct harm, direct personal harm from the environmental infringement, and a court has yet to recognize that as an issue, that it's occurred.
I get the feeling that our government's being taken over by this agreement. Originally, the government was there and granted charters to companies, but now it seems like the government's there to represent the interests of the companies to the citizens, and the citizens are really being left out of the process totally.
Well, it's your opinion. Many people think it's always been that way, and it's just sort of the coloration of history that's painted it in another light. But yeah, that is definitely the case at hand.
The contemporary world is such a complex place, it's almost impossible to comprehend, particularly in the new world order of commerce and the international trade situation. For instance, here's a story in the Spotlight from February 15th. Under the title World Turned Upside Down, it says the Commerce Department has ruled that an American company unfairly dumped electric typewriters in the United States, injuring a Japanese company. Now, did I read that right? Let's see. An American company dumped electric typewriters in the United States, injuring a Japanese company. Usually they say, you know, there's unfair dumping when a foreign country or company dumps at lower than prices it should be under normal situation, dumps products on a foreign market. But this is just the opposite. Well, the Japanese company is Brother USA, which operates a plant in Tennessee. Now, the American company, which is Smith Corona, imports most of its typewriters from Singapore. Now, Smith Corona is also closing its remaining plant in the United States and opening a new one in Mexico. So how can you buy an American product? You don't know. It may be owned by Japanese, or may you open up inside and there are a bunch of other parts that are made in different parts of the world. It's a crazy, crazy world.
Education has always been considered a one-way ticket up the socioeconomic ladder. But while college graduates have relatively bright futures, some futures are better illuminated than others. The average white male college graduate earned $6,000 more in 1987 than the average comparably educated Latino man, $8,000 more than his black male counterpart, and $13,000 more than a white woman counterpart.
In These Times has a story from their June 14th edition, and which gives a little bit more background on the famous GM business, where you remember when NBC had rigged these tests to show that the GM trucks would burst into flames, and GM was just, oh, they were terribly put off by this, and everybody thought, oh, poor GM, NBC had rigged these tests to show that the trucks would burst into flames, and in the Dateline NBC story, and as a result, some people got fired, including the head of NBC News. Well, In These Times says that the irony is that GM has been rigging its own crash tests for more than a decade, and that the automaker presented these doctored tests as evidence in courts of law. That's simply a made-for-TV visual ad. Here's what happened. It's so ironic that an Atlanta attorney, Jim Butler, says that just days before GM filed its suit against NBC, a Georgia jury awarded Butler's clients $105 million in damages against GM in an exploding gas tank case.
Now, going back a little bit, a successful 1983 suit against GM in California, lawyers for GM sprung a test crash film on the plaintiff's attorney with no warning in the middle of the trial. The film showed a staged accident involving the same circumstances as the one at issue at the trial. But instead of using a GM truck, GM defense lawyers used a Ford truck. And this Ford pickup truck, which had an in-frame gas tank instead of the controversial GM side saddle model, which everybody says should be replaced because it's a fire hazard, well, the Ford pickup truck exploded. And GM's argument was that since the impact was so violent, it didn't make any difference where the gas tank was, that would have burst into flames. But when presenting the film to the court, the defense attorneys didn't mention that the GM engineers had doctored the car that struck the Ford. So it would greatly increase the odds of an explosion. And this fact only came out on cross-examination of one of the GM engineers. Well, GM lost there, and the jury awarded more than $4 million. Now, Joe McRae, the lawyer who discovered GM's doctored evidence in the 1983 case, he says that there was another case in 1990 in which, again, GM substituted a Ford pickup for a GM truck to demonstrate that the controversial GM gas tank didn't trigger the explosion. But the gas tank of the Ford was punctured by a long bolt which was used on the bracketing around the tank. But according to the lawyer McRae, a post-manufacturer service bulletin, which the Ford people had put out, instructed this bolt be replaced. And so if the bolt had been replaced as required and requested, there would have been no puncture. But the GM hauled that out anyway recently. Now, by the time the 1993 trial came, the most recent one in Atlanta, the plaintiff's attorney said that the rigging has become so sophisticated by GM that it's nearly, but not quite, impossible to detect. So don't feel sorry for poor GM if NBC does a little of their own busy work on them.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. Because our program was recorded in different places and in different times, we have a lot of people to thank. Brian Lynch, Michelle Hogan, Kevin L. West, Eric Eubank, as well as Roger Nussenblatt, Maria Lopez, Catherine Galatera, and Joel May. We'd like to thank the producers of the documentary Deadly Corn, Labor Vision, 3323 Magnolia Avenue, St. Louis, Missouri, 63118. And we're very appreciative of the Allied Industrial Workers Local 837, AFL-CIO, 2882 North Dineen, Decatur, Illinois, 62526. Their phone number there is area code 217-876-7006. You can phone there or write there and see what you can do to help out. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. And after you get through writing and thanking all of the people we've talked about, you might drop a line to us, too. We'd like to hear from you. Goodbye.